Hello, everyone. It's me, Daisha. How for art thou? You're about to hear my conversation with John Schneider, who...
Just a good old boy. Never meaning no
harm. No. Not that John Schneider. Totally different guy. This John Schneider is a human man who does music-related things and who I'm going to introduce properly in just a moment. But first, I just wanted to take a moment to say that this was one of the most fascinating discussions I've had in a long time. John is just a natural teacher, and Harry Parch, about whom we talk, I mean, hold on to your hats, people. There are those who think outside of the box, and then there are those who are like, what is box? And then they just create their own universes altogether. That's what I like about Harry Parch, and I also like that he was hilarious. Like, think Tom Waits meets a brilliant classical musician meets a mad scientist or something. Also, don't forget, put it on your list to subscribe to, rate, and review our little show on iTunes. And also, if you'd like to support us with a gift from your bank account or your mom's, you can do so at classicalclassroomshow.com. It's a fabulous website made by our friends at New Y. You just look for the little pink tip jar button. I'm almost out of breath. Huh. All right. There's a rumor going around that classical music can be hoity-toity. But here in the classical classroom, we beg to differ.
Beethoven 5.
The idea that classical music is a zone where we have to feel restricted or we have to act in a certain way, you know, that's not going to be helpful going forward.
Isaiah is shaking with excitement.
Oh, here. I mean, there's just so many great parts of the opera.
He asked me to play his favorite spot in the first movement of the Brahms. And then he said, I started using those licks in my guitar solos.
How to be classical music rock stars, because there's not enough of that in this business.
Occasionally, I would plug in the mandolin to my distortion pedals.
I don't change my voice.
And talking to classical
voice. I'm playing classical music now. I mean, it's the same 12 notes. That's what's so cool about it.
I'm Daisha Clay, a classical music newbie, and I'm trying to learn all I can about the music. Come learn with me and the classical music experts I invite into the Classical Classroom.
And now for something completely different.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm your host, Tasha, and here with me is John Schneider. John is the music director of the Parch Ensemble. That ensemble just released Sonata Dementia, their third volume of music by composer Harry Parch. Volume 1 earned a Grammy nomination, and Volume 2 won a Grammy Award for Best Classical Compendium and was also nominated for Best Chamber Music Performance by the Grammy people. John, welcome.
Thank you.
So I want to talk just briefly for our listeners who don't know about who Harry Parch was and what his kind of musical legacy is.
Go for it. I would love to hear your take on it.
Well, I mean, I want to hear your take. You're the expert. So.
Okay, I'll go.
Okay, that sounds good. I feel like that's the appropriate way to go.
So Harry Parch was a composer, performer, theorist, and all of the above. He was born in 1901, died in 1974. And when he was in his late teens, he discovered a book called The Sensations of Tone by a German physicist. He had just entered college and realized that he wasn't getting what he needed. So he started educating himself out of library books. And he found out that there actually is another way of listening to music, of talking about music, that we can hear a lot more notes than he could find on his piano. And he found out the physics behind it, the whole theory behind it, and started building musical instruments. Basically, he started because the human voice, as you can tell right now, I'm not singing in scales, otherwise this would sound like an opera, right? Our regular talking voice slides up and goes down, and he wanted to figure out a way to capture that as a composer so he could reproduce it. So he ended up eventually creating a scale with 43 notes to the octave. Now, we normally on a piano have 12, and 43 is not bad. He got really angry later on. He says, no, 43 is totally arbitrary. It's a quarter part of a half truth. You can hear thousands of tones. I just 43 because that's how many I wanted to make on my instruments. And by the time he died, heavens, he had made over 30 custom musical instruments that could play this scale of 43 notes per octave and more when he needed to.
Wow. So what kind of instruments are we talking about? I know that, you know, in the new music tradition, like with John Cage and people like that, there are things like the prepared piano where things are sort of inserted into the piano to make it sound a little bit different and to get some different sounds out of it. But you're talking about whole new instruments.
Yes and no, and it's fascinating you should bring up Cage, because his first instruments, Partch's first instruments, he called adapted musical instruments. His first was an adapted viola, which was basically a viola, but he got a little crazy and had a violin maker put a cello neck and fingerboard on it, so the strings were longer, and that became his first instrument. The second was an adapted guitar. He bought a regular guitar, but he ripped the frets out and put them in all different places so he could play all these tiny notes.
Which it wanted to forget.
Then he made his first original instrument, which doesn't sound like it is. It's called a kithara or a kithara, but that's an ancient Greek instrument. He was very well versed in ancient Greek music, and he wanted to create something that was like that, but it wasn't a melodic harp, it was a harmonic harp. So instead of a whole line of single notes like the modern harp, it was a line of six chords times 12, so it had 72 strings. Ay, ay, ay. Now, he was a keyboard player, right? He was a pianist. He was actually trained to be a concert performer, so he knew keys. He then adapted a reed organ because the shape of a piano, of course, is determined by the length of the strings. The length of the strings is determined by 12 notes per octave. But when you have five or six C sharps, they go da-da-da-da-da-da, and then a bunch of Ds, da-da-da-da-da-da, piano strings don't work. There aren't enough of them. So he took an old-fashioned pump organ and removed the reeds and retuned them because they're all the same size and created what he called a chromalodeon.
That's a great name.
I know. They're amazing. It's sort of like Dr. Seuss stuff, right?
Yeah.
And at that point, he started making percussion instruments. And these were those weren't adaptations. They were brand new. A marimba whose keys, or blocks, if you will, were laid out in the shape of a diamond. He made a bass marimba where the keys were like 6 and 7 feet long and played really, really low notes. He cut huge, basically sparklets bottles, but they were lab bottles made out of Pyrex, and made cloud chamber bowls by cutting these huge things in half and making glass gongs.
Wow, I'm imagining this sort of like steampunk meets Willy Wonka, mad scientist man creating. But he's like creating these instruments out of what he sees as necessity.
Very much
not
so.
Not just for fun. He wasn't just messing around to accomplish some ends.
Exactly. He had a sound in his head that he was looking for and had to make them himself. He's the original DIY composer.
Wow. That is really DIY. The sort of best kind of DIY where it's like what you need to express yourself in whatever way, like literally doesn't exist, so you have to create it from the ground up. So I know that Harry Partch dealt in a lot of what is called microtones, And that's kind of, is that kind of what you're talking about here?
Well, that's exactly it. Because we're used to 12 notes per octave, but there's a whole bunch of notes you can hear in between those, and they're small. That's why they call them micro.
Mm-hmm.
So between a C and a C sharp on a piano, that's it. You can only go to the black note above the white note. But he has four or five notes in between those.
So what the thing is that what makes Partch sort of difficult, I guess, is I kind of want to get into the legacy that he's left us now before we get into the album, because here in Seattle, we've got the Harry Partch Institute at the University of Washington, and at the Harry Partch Institute, they have the Partch Instrumentarium, and they, you know, groups of people get together to play these instruments, and they'll take these instruments to other cities sometimes, but that kind of brings up that, you know, though Partch's music is so interesting and the thinking behind his music is so interesting, isn't it problematic? Because in order to play this music that he's left, you have to have these certain instruments. Like, how does your ensemble get around that?
I built new ones.
Of course you did.
at this point on the planet, there are the original instruments, which live in Seattle. There's my group, and we don't have them all yet. We have 20 out of 24 of the final versions of these instruments.
And you're making them?
Oh, yeah, one every year. Now, I personally am not making the sawdust. I hire luthiers and professionals, but I put the project together and tune them and help redesign them and that sort of thing. And I got to tell you, we're not the only one. After I got started, a German group got obsessed about this, a group called Musikfabrik. And they, with huge funding, I'm paying for all the stuff out of my own pocket, right? They got German government money and corporate money, and they built the entire set in a year. It's taken me 20 years to get up to 18, and I'm still working on them. So yeah, absolutely, you have to have the instruments, period. I mean, there it is.
Do you think that, like, and this is sort of a weird aside, but do you think that Partch, I mean, it sounds, like I said, he sounds kind of like a mad scientist, like he just became obsessed with this idea. Do you think he was even thinking about, like, okay, well, how does this music persist when I'm gone? And, you know, like, was he thinking about things in a broader context, or was he just a person who was sort of monomaniacally focused?
That is a great question, and I ask myself that often. And I think the answer is he wouldn't come right out and say it, but he wrote a book called Genesis of a Music, which literally told the story of all of his research and the instruments, how he built them, how they're tuned, et cetera, et cetera. Also, from the 1950s onward, he made recordings of his music. So he said several times in public, it's not the same as being in the room, but this is a document. This is how it's done. Now, you have to ask yourself, and I'm very fond of saying this, yes, Genesis of a Music is a theory book. It's a history book, but it's also a cookbook. If you pay very close attention, he's giving you the cues. Here's how you do it. Here's how you make them. So what I did, of course, was go over every sentence in great detail, but I had the luxury of living close to the instruments when they were in San Diego, and then they moved to the East Coast for a while, I would go visit them, and I would measure them, photograph them, record them, and come back and make copies. So yeah, I'm pretty sure at some level, you know, why else would you make all this incredible music, hours and hours of music? And I got to tell you, people get obsessed with the instruments, of course, because they're so weird and so wonderful. But, you know, there's lots of people on this planet that have made weird and wonderful instruments, but they didn't write great music for them. And that's really the cutoff point. It's all about the music.
Hey, everyone. I'm taking a break from my interview with John Schneider to tell you about our sponsor. This episode of Classical Classroom is sponsored by Maestro Classics. They're the creators of Stories in Music, which is this recorded series that they made for kids and families. It's won more than 50 awards, not to mention general adoration from the people who listen to it. It features the London Philharmonic Orchestra, and it takes those musical stories and it brings them to life. It's one of those things where kids learn while they're having fun. without actually knowing that they're learning. And there's an activity book that goes along with it. It's a whole thing. Maestro Classics just announced a brand new recording in this series called Bach and the Organ. It's all about J.S. Bach, who you may have heard of on this very show, and it tells the story of his life while talking about the pipe organ, which, P.S., back in the day, was the most advanced mechanical instrument that had ever existed. And you can learn more about this album and the rest of the series at maestroclassics.com, and wait for it, you can also save 17% off of your order by using coupon code CLASSROOM. Yay! Okay, and now back to my conversation with John Schneider. Well, okay, you're a Grammy-winning guitarist. You're classically trained. You have this traditional music education behind you. If one were to look into your biography, they would think this is a sane man trained, you know, in this music tradition. So what drew you to this very peculiar music, to this very peculiar composer's music, to which you've dedicated a lot of your life and time and money?
Same answer, the music. Hmm. When I was studying, I'm trained as a composer as well, and when I was studying modern music in the late 60s, early 1970s, all the rage was European avant-garde serial music. And then all the minimalism started to come in. But all of a sudden, I heard this music by Harry Parch, and it was visceral. And here's, I got to tell you, it was funny. That's what really got me. You mean you can have humor in music? If you've ever heard the piece Barstow, it's hilarious.
Number two. Gentlemen, go to 530 East Lemon Avenue, Monrovia, California, for an easy handout. Go to 530 East Lemon Avenue in Monrovia for an easy handout, gentlemen. Yo-ho-ho, 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 yo-ho-ho.
And all of a sudden I was hearing harmonies I didn't know existed before. And I thought, okay, this is good. And I basically, you know, I used to say I fell in love with the music, but it was more than love. It was actually lust. I had to obtain this music. It's like when you hear Bach and you go, oh, my God, that French suite is so beautiful. I want it underneath my fingers. That's the exact feeling I had about Parch. And the only way you could do it, as we said, you just got to do it yourself.
Yeah. You yourself become a DIYer. This album that you guys just put out, this is volume 3. Is it the final volume in a set, or is this an ongoing series?
Oh, we're just getting started.
You're just getting started. Okay. Well, so what is sort of framing the volumes? Like, is this all from a particular moment in Parch's life? He seems like he was a really prolific guy.
He was indeed. And in fact, we've sort of recapitulated his life. I have built the instruments in the same order that he did and made the music that he made with those instruments. His music was handed around, once again, he made a living selling his own LPs. Talk about independent music, right? This is in the 1950s. And then eventually they ended up on a label called Composers Recordings Incorporated when it was still the land of LPs. Now all of those are held by something called New World Records, and it's in 4 volumes of the music that he personally recorded. But we have at least 5 or 6 volumes to go. At least, because he wrote a couple of, so they're not really operas, but they are their music dramas. There are extraordinary pieces that are meant to be danced. And that's a whole other side. In fact, the plectra and percussion dances, that is a dance drama. Nobody's ever danced it. We've actually commissioned a choreography for one of the pieces, but this stuff is waiting to be manifested still.
Wow.
And it's not just the music. It's not just the instruments. People are supposed to move and be, well, the word he came up with, music should be corporeal. It should be of the body. It should be visceral. It should be emotional. He you know, you were talking about John Cage earlier. He knew John Cage. They ran into each other often. And he said, you know, the problem with Cage is he put the whammy on emotion. For Harry, it was all about emotion and also deep, well, there's a lot of psychology in there, too, and also a sense of humor and a sense of drama. He did not have an easy life, and some of his music is very dark. Very dark.
Yeah,
wasn't he
homeless for a little while?
Oh, a long while. A long while. Right. And in fact, some of that was self-imposed. He was a hobo during the 30s. That's what Volume 1 is, okay. is Bitter Music, which was his diary from six months in the middle of 1935 during the Depression. But he was following the crops. He was in homeless shelters. He got arrested for being a vagrant. He was, you know, picking fruit for a living, all the while creating this music in his head. And eventually in the 1940s, he got to work.
Wow. Well, and so in Volume 3, I know this comes from the sort of inspirations for these pieces come from a lot of different sources, but what was going on in Parch's life at the time that, you know, something like Ulysses at the Edge of the World, the first piece on the album?
That piece is hilarious. He was living in Sausalito, and he was hanging out with somebody who helped him build his magnificent marimba eroica, this contrabass eroica. And the guy that was helping him build it was a percussionist, and he played with Chet Baker. And the guy said, hey, why don't you write a piece for Chet?
Wow.
And he did. And that's what piece is. Now, eventually, that was the first version of this piece. And then later he added a baritone saxophone part because, of course, Chet Baker and Jerry Mulligan played together all the time. That's what this piece is. So that's from the mid-1950s. Now, the album is all over the map in terms of, it covers basically two decades worth of music. The earliest pieces are from 1949 and 1950. That's where Sonata Dementia comes from, 1949. He was living up on the coast, northern coast of Northern California, and he wrote a song cycle called The Intrusions. So that's all from that era. And then Sonata Dementia. The other piece is from the mid-50s, from 1958. In fact, it's a film score for a film called Windsong. And it is extraordinary. It's all about the myth of Daphne and Apollo. So he made that score, and he had to, like any film composer, he had to sort of cut it up a bit to fit the actual movie. Well, what we have done, I've recreated the original before any of the cuts happened. So no one, even Harry himself, has never heard this done completely from beginning to end. So this is the first time that's happening. And in all of our recordings, we always like Harry to come drop by and give us a couple of words. So at the very end, we've discovered a 1942 recording of Harry Parch performing his own piece, Barstow, for a group of students at Eastman in Rochester. And he gives a little talk beforehand. And that's one of the bonus tracks that ends the album.
These 8 Hitchhiker's Inscriptions, which I call Barstow, which I've set to music, I got just east of Barstow, California. I copied them from this railing. Barstow is in one of those peculiar situations that a hitchhiker finds only in the West. It is very easy to get into and almost impossible to get out of.
The last one of the intrusions is something called Cloud Chamber Music, which features the Cloud Chamber bowls, those glass Pyrex bowls that are cut. But what he did is quote an Indian chant from the Isleta Indian tribe in Arizona. He was actually paid to transcribe it. It was an Edison recording, one of those Edison rolls.
Yeah.
And he remembered it and put it in that piece. Well, we found the original Edison roll. So in the album, there's two bonus tracks. There's Harry singing in 1942, and then there's Ramon singing the Canción de los Muchachos from 1904.
Canción de los Muchachos, cantado por Ramon.
So we get the source, and then we get Parch's gloss on it. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, well, I went to the 12 intrusions. I think, like, as I was looking through those, speaking of where Parch kind of took his various inspirations, I was just. There's voice in this, and I think it's your voice. Now that I'm talking to you, I'm realizing it's your voice.
Oh, yeah, that's me.
In a lot of these pieces, and they come from sources like letters, from pieces in literary journals, from...
Ancient Chinese verse, yeah.
Yeah.
He was very well-read, very literate.
Yeah. It seems like all of these things that he was interested in just kind of made their way into his work.
Very much so. When you say my voice, we might want to warn or invite our listeners to know that this isn't singing. He called it intoning. So he wrote the exact, when I go like this and my voice goes up, he would actually show where that was supposed to go. So I'm
really?
Actually speaking at the pitch levels that he would have used himself. And in fact, it's even better than that, because in 1949, up in Wallala in Mendocino County, he actually recorded some of those pieces, those intrusions. So we know exactly how he intoned them. It's written out, and thank heavens, we have a recording as well. Bach, we don't have recordings of, but Parch, we do.
Suddenly tall on the ruins is the clear stupor of immensity, and the man bent over the water, surprised by the sun, makes himself out as a shadow, rocked by the water and sea alone.
That's kind of great. Like that, you can actually hear what the composer intended.
Oh yeah, that's gold.
And it reminds me so much of like Tom Waits. It has a really similar. I kept thinking about Tom Waits as I was listening to this. It's that very similar sort of sense of humor too.
Absolutely.
The intoning and
Tom Waits is a great Parch fan too.
Oh well, that makes so much sense now.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
I've always known that there was, I mean, Tom Waits is just a great character, but like there's something very particular, like he seems to come out of a tradition. So that makes a lot of sense. Speaking of traditions, I want to know, like this music is, I mean, it's really arresting. It's great. To listen to. I was drawn in as soon as I turned on the CD and I was wondering how this is linked to the classical music tradition. How is it linked, and where does it depart?
Well, it's not for nothing that he called it a sonata dementia, right? It's in three different movements. It has different moves. The middle movement is slower. The wind song piece is virtually like an opera. There are leitmotifs. There's a theme for Daphne. There's a theme for Apollo. I mean, he played the greats, even to the end of his life. Sometimes when he was in the mood, he would go over to the piano and play a Brahms piece. So he knew about the structure of music, but he invented, just the way he invented new scales and new instruments, he invented some new structures too. There's a piece called Castor and Pollux from our second album, which is, as far as I know, it's the second time ever in Western music where a composer takes music and plays it first here and then plays something new and then plays something new, but then has all three parts played simultaneously. It's an overlay. It's a multiple exposure. Darius Milhaud did that with his string octet. The first half was his string quartet number 3 or whatever it is. The second half was, he wrote a completely different string quartet number 4, but his octet was 3 and 4 played at the same time. So in Harry Parch, he's got a 2-minute duo with 2 instruments, and then brand new music for 2 more instruments, brand new music for 2 more instruments, and then all 6 of them play at the same time. And that happens twice because, of course, Castor and Pollux are the twins of Gemini, right? That's taking a concept, a structure that doesn't exist in Western music, except for Darius Milhaud, which I don't think he knew that piece of music, but it's completely logical, it's structural, and it's no different from having a recapitulation or a development section. It's a method of taking music that is familiar and seeing it from a different point of view.
So I think what I'm hearing you say is that this is the tradition that he came from and knew well, and he knew the framework and the theory and all of that behind it, but he took it and did kind of his own thing with it.
Well, heck, isn't that exactly what Beethoven did?
Fair point.
Yeah, I mean, he took the classical forms and just twisted them, and the critics and the audiences were just so confused, and some of them were just indignant. And then, you know, Beethoven himself says, oh, no, this isn't for you. This is for future generations. And he was right. And I got to tell you, Parch, very much, for the years before he made his first big recording deal at the end of his life with Columbia Records, he was trying to tell people, this is a new way. I'm not trying to destroy Western music. I love Western music. I'm trying to go somewhere else. I'm trying to cause ferment.
Well, and I mean, isn't that what happens to so many creators who are steeped in a tradition who then realize where that tradition can go when taken to a new place, and then they face a lot of protest from the powers that be that want to keep things as they are, but like everybody who's ever moved the tradition forward has sort of faced that, haven't they?
Oh yes, absolutely. You know, Nicholas Leninsky has this wonderful book called A Lexicon of Musical Invective, meaning he put together chapter after chapter of chapter of all the bad reviews that the great composers got in their own era.
Oh, that's amazing.
Oh, it's hilarious to read, right? You'd think that this music was just like you'd want to just throw it away. But these are the greats. This is the standard classical canon that we listen to now. And Parch very much said the same thing. This is new. This is something that needs to be, embraced because it's a new one. Why would you? Well, he wrote beautifully as well as he spoke. At one point he said, consider the artist. If he wants red, great. I mean, he can, but what if he wants red that's a little lighter and has a little, well, he can take a little white paint and mix it in. He can take a little blue paint and he can create the palette he wants exactly. Now let's look at the musician. If he wants a note C, there it is. What if he wants something a little, no, sorry. There's only one C. Why shouldn't we as musicians be able to have shades of C, shades of C sharp, in order to create something new, a new oral language instead of a visual language? And, you know, it's taking off. People are listening. You know, ever since computers got involved, microtonality, this whole concept, you know, 12 notes per octave, we can actually hear as many as 500 to 600 notes per octave. we are physically capable of differentiating upwards to 600 pitches. Why are we only using 12?
Wow. That is a really, really excellent point. And I think also a good place for us to stop. But John, this conversation has been absolutely fascinating, as is this album. It's absolutely arresting. And thank you so much for taking the time to teach me about this today. And we should definitely talk again.
Excellent, excellent. Hey, we'll talk when Volume 4 comes out.
Sounds great. I'm going to hold you to that. All right, John Schneider of the Parch Ensemble, thanks for talking to me at King FM today.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks. All right, everyone, that does it for this episode. For more episodes, go to classicalclassroomshow.com for an exhausting, I mean exhaustive, archive of all of our old episodes, social media links, free balloon animals, and your wildest internet dreams come true. Woo! Thanks today to the home of Classical Classroom, King FM, where we only clean when guests are coming over. Shh, tell no one. Thanks to the birthplace of Classical Classroom, Houston Public Media. Thanks to the official dry cleaner of Classical Classroom, Dick's Dry Clean and Drive-In. Get your suit cleaned while you watch a movie of our choosing, which is almost always Footloose. Just over and over. Thanks to John Schneider for being on the show. Thanks to me for saying words. But most of all, thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time.